Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Hey, this is Sam Cedar. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Yes, we survived our trip to Las Vegas, Nevada, and on today's show, we'll have interviews from the Mass Torts Made Perfect 2018 conference, the largest plaintiff attorney seminar in the country. Attorney Brian Witzer will tell us an amazing legal battle he is facing after helping a 15-year-old boy whose body began to blister and burn after taking Motrin. Jessica Pride will explain why the Me Too movement has emboldened women to speak out against sexual harassment in the workplace and why she devotes her time to helping those affected. Human rights attorney Gavi Marone will join us to discuss why he sued a German company for its involvement in making chemical weapons for Saddam Hussein. And Heather Digby Parton from Salon.com will be here to break down the biggest news stories of the week. And finally, we'll hear from a former tobacco defense lawyer, Bethany Schneider, on why she made the switch to protect consumers from protecting big corporations. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze some of the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her Uber blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, obviously a tremendous amount of news this week, unlike other weeks. We are in the wake of the attack on Syria, which fortunately appears to have been rather modest and contained, as far as we know, no loss of life, which I'm happy about. I would prefer no attack, but just basically lobbing a couple of missiles into the Mediterranean and everybody walking away with them all having bragging rights seems like a relatively good outcome. And of course, the story that still unwinding from last week was the revelation that there were Michael Cohen, the President Trump's personal attorney, in testimony revolving around Stormy Daniels' case, revealed that his third client of the past 2 years, after Donald Trump and a major Republican donor, was in fact Sean Hannity, of all people. Give me your first reaction.
Well, my first reaction was to, you know, high five my husband. We both kind of did a little, you know, dance in the middle of the living room upon hearing it. It was one of the few moments in the last year or so that I've actually had the, a moment of pure joy at hearing. And in fact, I don't know if you saw the Stephen Colbert reaction that night. I think it was on Monday night of this past week. But it's hilarious. You should go to YouTube and watch it, because you can imagine after all the years that he spent and Jon Stewart spent on The Daily Show also, you know, skewering Hannity, nothing could be more satisfying to them and to me, to be honest. I mean, it was an amazing thing because, you know, there's a lot to sort out in that whole story, and I'm not sure we even have touched the surface of it as of yet. But, you know, the fact is, I mean, what we know up to now is that the feds have been tracking and have been looking into Cohen's businesses for months, apparently. Some of this apparently came from a referral from Mueller, but clearly there's a whole bunch of other stuff here. Now, we don't know yet whether or not Mueller uncovered this stuff in the course of his investigation of Russia. And by the way, Cohen's involved in that stuff, too. It's not this particular case, but he is involved because Mueller, there are numerous reports of him, you know, interrogating witnesses with some very serious, you know, subpoenas and requirements that they test, grand jury subpoenas, that they talk about Cohen's involvement in these overseas deals, which does not appear to be part of the Southern District of New York case, which is about Cohen and his taxi medallions. And we are assuming a lot of it has to do with the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal and various other hush money schemes that he and Donald Trump and at least one other client, which the man named, I think it's Elliot Broidy, who's a big RNC Trump donor and RNC finance chairman, who he also arranged a payoff to a Playboy playmate of. And then there is Sean Hannity. And when they went to court on Monday, it was because they were claiming this big, you know, sweeping attorney-client privilege on the previous Friday when they first went to court. And the judge is going, well, and, you know, the U.S. attorney had said, well, look, this isn't really about his legal work. This is about some business deals that he did. And they were saying, no, they, you know, there's all this information about my clients. And the judge said, well, how many clients do you have, and who are they? And they said, well, we can't really answer because Michael Cohen at the time was out hanging with his Goombas on the street corner smoking cigars and didn't bother to come to court. So she said, all right, bring your client in on Monday, and I want to know who these people are, what this, you know, what his clients are. I need to know about that before I can make a ruling about attorney-client privilege. They come in on Monday, say, well, he's got three clients. Are we going, three? Okay, and we know about the two, right? Donald Trump and this guy, Elliot Broidy, that was public knowledge. Who's the third? And the guy said, well, the lawyer says, well, we didn't really, you know, this person doesn't want to be named, has said explicitly that he does not want to be named publicly. And the judge goes, eh, no, I don't think so. You're going to tell me. And he did. Well, and
no, wait a second. Hannity. There's one other interim step, which I think also captures Michael Cohen and all of these guys perfectly. The Cohen's lawyer said, well, we'll tell you, but we just want to make sure that Michael Cohen's not going to be disbarred for being unethical by naming this client after the client has said, don't name me. And the judge said, no, you're fine because I'm ordering you to tell me. And the guy's like, oh, okay, Sean Hannity. And that was it.
Yeah, oh, it's Sean Hannity. Yeah.
Yeah, as long as we're not going to pay a price, sure, I got no problem throwing him under the bus.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll throw him under the bus. Not a problem at all. Well, you know, nobody knows what this is about, right? I mean, what he was representing Sean Hannity. But, of course, the first suspicion that comes to your mind is, what if Michael Cohen appeared to be specializing in at this point?
Right.
And it appears to be, you know, he's paying off
two-thirds of my clients. I pay off
playmates,
adult
and porn stars.
Actresses to not report the fact that they've had affairs, and then one-third I just do some advising on real estate transactions.
Right, and of course, you know, because Sean Hannity, you know, he's worth over $80 million. He has his own private jet. He can't afford to get a real estate attorney, so he has to, you know, he has to hire Michael Cohen, the man who went to the worst law school in the country and clearly is not the sharpest tool in this shed because, by the way, we find out in the course of this whole thing that he's been recording conversations for crying out loud. I mean, this is a guy who's claiming attorney-client privilege, but he recorded his clients.
You do got to wonder, I mean, you know, that part about Hannity having the money, like, if Michael Cohen had advice that was worthwhile, why wouldn't Hannity have hired him as his attorney? I mean, what, there was clearly something about the relationship that they wanted to keep super secret, and there must have been some illicit part about it, and I have a feeling we're going to find out sooner rather than later, and it is fascinating. When we come back, Let's talk a little bit more about Michael Cohen and who he is, because, and then I guess we got to move on to the other big story who works and who's in the same sort of orbit, and that's James Comey. And of course, there was he was all over the place this week.
Yep.
We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Digby, Heather Parton, after this. Sam Seder here. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking about the beginning of the week, the sort of the startling revelation that Michael Cohen had three clients, one of whom was Donald Trump, one of whom was a friend of Donald Trump, who was also a big Republican donor. And we should remind people that Michael Cohen was like, what, vice chair of the RNC fundraising?
Right.
And the third client was Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity on his radio program and his TV show was like, I don't understand why people are so focused on this. What's the big deal here? And then saying like, of course I had client privilege with him. Maybe I gave him $10, which is, you know, that's not strange. You're a multimillionaire. You're developing enough of a relationship with an attorney that you would just, there's $10 so that we can have client attorney client privilege. That is, incidentally, my understanding is an old mob trick, although my understanding is also you don't need to give money, but that sort of, I guess, is one more piece of evidence that you should have that relationship. And for whatever reason, Sean Hannity doesn't say like, well, maybe I'll throw you, you know, I don't know, $40,000. You'll be one of my attorneys on retainer. That doesn't happen. So clearly there's more to that story. We should also say that in terms of like Michael Cohen, there was some reporting this week by Josh Marshall that Michael Cohen, through his uncle, owned a part of a social club called El Caribe Social Club. This was out, I think, in parts of Brooklyn. It's a Brooklyn social club. It was a well-known meeting spot for members of the Italian and Russian organized crime families in the 70s and 80s. But it also turns out to have been a headquarters of Russian organized crime currently, and through the 90s at least, and that Michael Cohen owned a piece of this until the day that he gave up his stake, the day that President Trump was elected, which is a coincidental time to do it and weird. I mean, you own part of a social club. Why not? Just keep it. I mean, what possible reason would you want to divest yourself of that when your number one client is getting a lot more scrutiny? We'll never know, I guess, or maybe we will know. But I mean, I've speculated for a long time before we get to Comey. I've speculated for a long time, and apparently Cohen's a longtime friend of Felix Sater, who it's clear now was a CIA and FBI asset. In what exactly? Some of it was counterterrorism, you know, which could be tracking arms sales through organized crime, et cetera, and other things. It does seem, and I've speculated for a long time, that, you know, you had Donald Trump basically involving himself with the mafia, with the Russian mob, perhaps, and not understanding that when he asked his friend Boris to go, you know, the guy who he knows is stealing credit card numbers, to go and maybe do some data crunching, that he was actually talking to a potential person who works for Russian intelligence agencies or whatnot. I mean, but it's quite clear that Donald Trump is very concerned about Michael Cohen. And last week they pardoned Scooter Libby as a way of sort of saying, look what I can do. But it's fascinating, the tentacles on this thing. And I think we're still very much at the surface.
Well, I do too. And, you know, I mean, Trump himself, I mean, this I think Cohen came to work for him in, what, 2006, I think? So he's been with him for more than a decade. And they, by all accounts, have been very closely aligned on a number of things. And Cohen, as I mentioned earlier, has been involved in some of this overseas stuff, too. I mean, he was the guy who was setting up the Moscow Trump Tower. There's a deal in Azerbaijan with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. There's one in Indonesia that's all just dirty money all the way. They're doing a big investigation down in Brazil. And Cohen was involved in a lot of this stuff. And some of this has to do with, I don't have any proof of this, but it seems like there's an international money laundering component here that would be reasonable to assume might have something to do with all this Ukrainian connection, Russian mob, et cetera, et cetera. So I would assume that's where Mueller's investigation on that side is going. Now, what's happening here in the U.S., obviously the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of New York is going to have some very, very strong leverage against Michael right. Cohen here, it appears. So we'll see. And, you know, they can work in tandem. I mean, that's not something that they can have leverage over Cohen in the one case in order to talk about the other case. Let's just put it that way.
Yep.
So, I mean, and Trump himself has been, you know, the Taj Mahal, by the way, as recently as 2015, was fined the highest fine in history for a casino in the United States for money laundering violations. They were routinely laundering money through that hotel when Trump was owning it and afterwards. And in fact, it was known back in the 90s as the hangout for the Russian mob. They'd go down there to Atlantic City. They were running huge sums of money through that casino, and they were being fined. The casino was being fined for it all the time, but, you know, they just paid the fine, right? I mean, that was just how the whole situation
cost
worked.
Cost of doing business.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say one thing before we move on to another subject. Imagine the hubris of a man like Donald Trump thinking that none of this was going to come out, and so he's going to run for president, and, you know, with the most, the brightest spotlight on the planet is on that particular person, right? I mean, there is nothing more. Well, now, granted, he assumed he was going to take a lot of power along with that, but what kind of a person with these shady dealings would decide that he's going to become president?
Well, I'll tell you,
United States?
We only have 30 seconds, but let me give you my quick answer. One is, I don't think he ever thought he was going to win, and I think they all thought that they would escape any type of scrutiny in a perfect sort of producers, and I'm talking about the play in the movie now, scenario where we can take 600% of the money for the financing for the play, but if it goes out of business, everybody loses their money. We don't have to account to anybody. And I also think that Felix Sater, who was clearly connected to the New York FBI office, I think there's a Whitey Bulger aspect to this, and I have a feeling a lot of these guys thought that they were completely protected. But we have to take a break. Yeah. Digby will be back with more in the next hour. Stick around with me because we got a lot to talk about. Coming up, human rights attorney Gabby Marone will explain how a German company ended up helping Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Seder. We'll be back with a new show next week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Our next interview from the Mass Torts Made Perfect, a plaintiffs-only legal conference put together by our own Mike Papantonio and his law firm, Levin Papantonio. Pap is teaming up with Gabby Marone to hold banks and corporations accountable when they finance or support terrorism. Here to tell us the story of how a German corporation helped Saddam Hussein build his chemical weapon plants is human rights attorney Gabby Marone. Continuing our coverage at Mass Torts Conference 2018, I'm with Gabby Marone, who is an international human rights attorney, and you specialize in tracking financing of terrorist activities, and you have now filed a suit against a company that was involved in providing Saddam Hussein with the material support to essentially commit an act of genocide against the Kurds in the north through chemical warfare, and to some extent Iran in the context of the Iranian Iraq-Iran war. So, all right, tell us who are the defendants in this case?
Okay, so we've actually alleged that seven European companies and 15 individuals conspired with the Saddam regime to commit genocide. It's a heavy allegation, and it's more than just providing material support. The primary defendant is the largest tourism company in the world, which in those days was a huge West German conglomerate called Prusag, which changed its name to TUI, T-U-I, and they were in the business of steel, of equipment manufacturing, and of chemicals. And TUI met with members of Iraqi military intelligence and agreed to take their chief lawyer, a guy named Salah Majid, who didn't speak a word of English, who happened to be married to a German woman, knew English, but he's an Iraqi lawyer, and they brought him to Hanover, Germany in 1980, and we've interviewed him and so on. He claims that he was hired to be the chief lawyer for international tenders for this giant conglomerate without speaking a word of German, and he worked there until the day that the Saddam regime was toppled and still doesn't speak German, and that he claimed that the reason he was given the job was because German lawyers don't know how to speak English. And he was, in fact, the mole or the cover given to him by TUI to organize the entire weapons procurement program for Iraq clandestinely in Europe. He told us that he, even though he was the chief lawyer for tenders for TUI, he was allowed to work at the same time for TUI's competitors in helping them do tenders. So there's no question he was really working for Saddam Hussein. And they put together a plan with multiple companies to build the entire chemical weapons facilities in Iraq, which became the largest chemical weapon plants in the world during the Cold War in Iraq, during a time of sanctions also. And most of the companies that were major participants came from West Germany. So, for instance, we have copies of letters and emails that one West German company writes to another named Heilberger, and they say, okay, we've been contracted to build the, quote, pesticide, quote, factory, which we know is what they call devil's kitchen. And they labeled the buildings as bunkers because they were built underground. In fact, they built seven factories and labs, and then they built what they called seven dummy buildings above ground. This whole plant was outside of Samarra in the middle of the desert on a military base with machine guns on every building, tanks, and surface-to-air missiles surrounding the entire complex. Typical factory, right? And all the buildings were built underground with 1 meter thick reinforced concrete roofs and 2 meters of hardened clay above it to protect from air bombardment. The buildings were empty shells so that if someone tried to bomb the pesticide plants, they would hit the empty buildings. So the point here is there was absolutely no question they were building chemical weapons factories and not pesticide plants.
In fact, the initial plans were tendered to an American company, you told
Correct.
Me. So just tell that story as further evidence that there was it was unreasonable for this German conglomerate to not understand what they were doing.
Right. Exactly correct. There's a company called Pufuder, it's hard to pronounce, it's Pufuder. And in 1975, the Saddam regime approached this company through the Ministry of Agriculture in Iraq, saying they want to build a pesticide plant. And so they sent two of their engineers out to Iraq to see the site, and they drew up blueprints of what a pesticide plant would normally look like. And then the Ministry of Agriculture requested some modifications and enlargements. When the management in America saw what the modifications were, they immediately washed their hands of the project and withdrew. Then, a year later, these plans appeared in a company in England called Imperial Enterprises. and with the same request to continue on with the specs and plans. And not only did they refuse, but they contacted a British intelligence, and that was reported in the Washington Post that this could be used for chemical weapons. And so then Iraq stepped back, and they reorganized everything under the Ministry of Technology and Weapons, called SOTI. It was run by military intelligence. And all the contracting from this point on goes between these companies and military intelligence in Iraq.
But still, supposedly about agricultural products.
Right. So the code name for the project was Project 922, and they labeled it as pesticide plants. And there was over 100 German engineers during the years that were on site. Each one of the German companies that are defendants had offices in Baghdad. So they absolutely knew what it is. Military intelligence officials were constantly at their offices. And we have that from testimony and interviews, because in the 90s, some of these people were prosecuted in Germany for illegal export of weapons, without saying chemical weapons, but that was all they exported. They all testified, for instance, they were on the base. They never saw anything. They were only there on days that nothing was being produced, that there was never one drop of pesticide ever produced in this base, in these plants. One of the things that they were requested to do is you would have air circulation in factories, especially where you're dealing with pesticide. And normally the standard was that you would replace the entire atmosphere of the factory, you know, once every 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like
this.
So
the airflow is such that you have fresh air going through.
So they installed air handlers that every 30 seconds replace the entire air, which is much, you're dealing with toxins that are totally not like pesticide.
Right.
They also built what they called in German an, quote, inhalation chamber. Cute. It was a gas chamber. This was to test the, quote, pesticide. And if you were thinking, okay, what are pests for pesticide? It would be like little tiny bugs or something like this. So how big of an inhalation gas chamber would you need? You can think about it. It would fit on this table. It was 3 meters by 3 meters by 2 meters, large enough to fit donkeys. And we have evidence that they started out testing it with dogs, then donkeys, then Iranian prisoners of war were tested in it. And then they built a what they called an incinerator, which you can think of today's Holocaust Remembrance Day. You can think of the ovens in Auschwitz to go ahead and incinerate the carcasses after they killed them in the gas chamber. And this is, again, a West German companies did this. So it's just astounding.
All right, Gavi Marone, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about who the plaintiffs are in this case. And just get a sense of time. And then ultimately, you know, what happened to these facilities? I mean, obviously, the arguments of the Iraq War were that the Saddam Hussein regime had weapons of mass destruction. We'll talk about that. And obviously, they weren't made up from whole cloth. But the question was, did they still have them in 2003 when the United States invaded? All right, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, continuing the coverage of the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. We return to my interview with Gavi Marone, who is telling us the story of a German corporation which helped Saddam Hussein build chemical weapons factories, which was used in genocide against the Kurdish people. Here's that now. Continuing our coverage at the 2018 Mass Torts Conference, I'm here with Gavi Marone. He is an international human rights lawyer who much of his work, and we've talked in the past about your pursuit of terrorism financing through banks and corporations, most often than not oil companies. But you have filed a case against a German corporation that the claim is that they knowingly helped Saddam Hussein build facilities for chemical weapons that were used in genocide of Kurds in the north of Iraq, as well as during the Iran-Iraq war. So you told us in the last segment how clearly obvious it was that the German corporation had been contracted to build not a pesticide facility, but rather a chemical weapons facility. Who are the plaintiffs in this case?
So we have approximately 4,000 plaintiffs. 3,000 of them actually were killed by the weapons, the estates of 3,000 people, and roughly 1,000 surviving family members, many of which are injured. All of the injured are dying. They've lived horrible lives where they had 10 to 20% of their lung capacity. The rest, they were blinded by the mustard gas. It depends how serious they were injured by which gas, because cocktails were used of different gases on Halabja and 400 other villages across the Kurdish region. And if you were harmed by mustard gas is a blistering agent, which also destroys your lungs and blinds you, destroys your cataracts. But many times you could survive, but then whatever's left of your life is in pain every moment. Nerve gas kills you very rapidly, and two nerve gases were used, sarin and tabun. Sarin is the same nerve gas that the Assad regime used last week in Damascus. And if you survive the nerve gas, you actually recover. And so of the roughly 900 and something surviving family members, we still have 143, we had 144 2 weeks ago, who were mustard gas victims, and they're suffering horrible, painful lives. And the rest of them were nerve gas victims, or a few of them weren't there in the day of the attack. And so they've just lost, like, for instance, one client is the sole surviving son, and he lost 17 brothers, sisters, parents, and so on.
And this is taking place during, essentially, from 83 to 89, I believe?
That's when, yes, the plants were started to be built in 81. Starting in 83, it was documented by the United Nations Secretary General and UN reports every 6 months, that, and then numerous media reports, that Iraq was using chemical weapons on Iranian soldiers. They also did two giant massacres against the Kurds, not with chemical weapons, but they slaughtered thousands of Kurds in those massacres. In 1987, they started using chemical weapons against their own Kurds, I mean Iraqi citizens, through 88. Chemical weapons were a key in a genocide, a key component of a genocide in which 180,000 Kurds were killed. Mm. During this time. And what the Iraqi army did was, because the Kurds are in the mountains in all kinds of villages, as you saw how long it took to defeat ISIS, it would have taken them years to try to go village by village. What they wanted to do is to kill every living thing in a strip from one side to the other, the entire Kurdish region. And we've got copies of the orders, every living thing, all animals, plants, and humans. And so what they would do is they would surround an area with a number of villages with the army on the roads, and then they would bombard for 2 days with chemical weapons the villages. Everyone would flee into the waiting arms of the troops. Then they would be boarded. They would be taken on trucks and buses. Normally the men and the women were separated. By men, we mean 10-year-old boys until 70-year-old men. Those were all then machine gunned into trenches and killed in the desert. And the women were put into concentration camps and later what they were called resettlement villages. So they basically lived a life with no men. So during the first 7 months of the slaughter, that's how they did it. The last 2 months, they killed the women and girls and everybody.
So what happened to these facilities and to what was manufactured there? By 2003, it was quite clear that there was no major caches of this material. What happened to it?
So as part of the ceasefire in the first Gulf War in 91, Iraq committed, under UN supervision, with the United States had a big presence in, the destruction of all of its chemical weapons stockpiles and facilities and biological weapons, and if there was any nuclear. So for the next months, base by base, building by building, they were all destroyed, and the chemical weapons were all taken, and they were neutralized. And more or less, that was complete. And the Iraqi regime was required to report to the United Nations how it obtained all the materials and from whence, and a description, which is a good part of our evidence.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, I would imagine at that point, as it's being dismantled, the United Nations is logging, like, where did this stuff come from? What were the means in which it was made?
Exactly, and Iraq was required to disclose. They never disclose 100% of everything. So theoretically, all of the chemical weapons then were destroyed, and all of the chemical weapons plants destroyed. So we saw in Syria recently that supposedly all the chemical weapons were exported out of Syria, but then somehow they have some again. So prior to the Second Gulf War, I guess, the United States figured that there must be more chemical weapons, or they must have rebuilt them, or, you know, and that's what they publicly stated was the reason for that war. And we know that they never found any more weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, we have just about a minute and a half left. How is it that in 1992, let's say, around that time, the UN is logging this material and presumably whatever type of machinery or technology, and, you know, it's not like this stuff is made in everybody's backyard. Pretty clear where, at least some sense, how is it this material has been sitting there for almost 40 years? Or I guess, 25 years.
And no, the materials were all destroyed.
No, but I'm saying the information.
The documents.
Yes, the documents. We just have about a minute left. I mean, how is it that this is only happening now?
Who else? First of all, you're talking about poor people who are scattered amongst villages out in Kurdistan with no access to lawyers that would do something. So who went there? I mean, I happen to go there, and since 2005, been going to Iraq back and forth, open offices there. So it's a huge investment of time and money to do it. Who else reached out to them? So, and why did no one else do it? The only thing I can mention is that the trials of Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali and all those after the liberation of Iraq, right? The law that set up the court to do it had a specific provision that you could only bring to trial individuals and not companies. Why that law said that?
Who set that law up?
Well,
the CPA?
The Iraqi government, but of course during the time that... So I mean, I don't know. I can just speculate. But from my perspective, what we have is, forgetting about the politics of it all, which I'm really not focused on,
right,
is that here we have corporate greed, willing to make money on the death and suffering of people, you know, and being with impunity and never once ever being held accountable. And that's what we're trying to change.
Gavi Marone, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to help support this program. Hey, this is Sam Cedar. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. We are back. It's the second hour of the show. If you're just joining us, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and listen to the whole episode commercial-free by becoming a member. Back to help me run down the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, the other big story, of course, this week was, or one of the other ones, I guess, was James Comey, his book dropping. There was all sorts of excerpts. You know, I don't know how much new in terms of data points we learned, other than my favorite part about Donald Trump insisting that he was not the type of guy who would need a prostitute to James Comey and the awkwardness that Comey felt. But he's been going on his book tour, and, you know, my sense is this is a guy who is looking to sell some books. Good for him. And I'm glad that he was essentially a prop in this play where Donald Trump fired him. But this is a guy who broke the primary directive of public corruption investigations in terms of the Justice Department. He broke that primary directive in announcing the investigation about Hillary Clinton. And this is a guy who really, by all accounts, if you're going to measure him in any way as an FBI director, should be considered a total failure. I know people who literally sat in an auditorium and James Comey told them during their orientation for a U.S. attorney, because they, you know, obviously there's subsidiary U.S. attorneys around the country, what we never do is want to be involved in affecting the outcome of an election. And you never talk about an investigation months before an election. You just don't do it. And he did it ostensibly because he wanted to protect the integrity of Hillary Clinton's election. But, you know, I think also just because he was sort of he's a coward himself. And you see it in his talk, even about how the Republican Party has changed. We'll talk more about that. But the Republican Party has not changed, folks. This is not Donald Trump was not, you know, beamed from another planet and all of a sudden showed up and had some type of special elixir. The Republican Party groomed their voters for Donald Trump, not vice versa.
Well, this is true. I mean, you know, I wrote, you know, endless. Columns about Comey during the election. He drove me nuts. And I consider him to be, I used the term showboat for him before Donald Trump did. So, you know, and I said, I don't have any regrets about that or in any way have changed my view. He is a sanctimonious showboater. The guy believes, and in some ways, you know, I mentioned in an earlier segment that, you know, that Donald Trump's hubris in thinking that he could run for president. Well, I wrote a piece this week sort of comparing him to Comey, who is also afflicted by that same major character flaw, which is that he thought that he could substitute his judgment, his political judgment, yep, his morality, his intellectual capacity for the judgment of the Justice Department, which had, for very good reasons, and which you just said, he told everyone else in the Justice Department they needed to adhere to, that you don't interfere in elections. There were good reasons why the Justice Department, the FBI director, whomever, does not step up and start injecting himself into it. And he got himself into that mess. And in his whole tour here, you know, he's not really copping to that. He's come up with a lot of excuses. He said that, you know, he was trying to protect. I mean, this idea that he was protecting Clinton's integrity, I think, is a bit much. He was afraid that the right wing was going to go after him and that he was going to be held responsible when she ran. He knew there was going to be just endless calls for her impeachment and jailing and whatever, and that he would be the one that they would blame because he didn't, you know, he didn't indict her during the election or whatever. And he was trying to allay those kinds of accusations against himself and against the, you know, the FBI.
But even if
he
was...
But none of that matters. I mean, this guy's
right.
going
well,
around
that's the thing,
saying
is
that he's
even
the moral arbiter, right? I mean, come on.
Yes. I mean, even if we take him at face value, right? That, I mean, I can understand this mentality. And I think, you know, a year ago, you know, you and I talked about this theory that he thought it was inevitable she was going to win. Donald Trump had already threatened her in a debate, like, I'm going to prosecute you. He knows that there's an ongoing investigation about Donald Trump, and he wants to protect the integrity, the way that that investigation is perceived. So he's going to show that he's fair-handed by breaking DOJ policy and thinking that he had, and that is the ultimate hubris, right? That he, that his judgment, I can supplant the painstaking. I mean, this is when that policy counts,
right? Like,
yeah.
this is where the rubber meets the road. And for him to sort of say, like, my acquired knowledge is better than that is the hubris. And it really ultimately was about protecting his integrity,
yeah,
and his reputation, and trying to maintain his, continued acceptance at the country club or whatever it was. And so, yes, even if I give him the best interpretation and the most generous interpretation, what he did was reprehensible. And frankly, it is annoying to see this guy go around and profit off of this. And then, you know, the sanctimonious stuff about how the Republican Party has left me, you know, short of, and someone corrected me today about this, I was going to say short of like the tariffs that Trump has issued, it turns out that that George W. Bush, you know, issued some Chinese tariffs too in 2004 or whatever it was, in 2005. There is no daylight between Donald Trump's vision for America and the Republican Party's vision for America. The only difference is that Donald Trump is rude. But everything else is pure and pure Republicanism. And for him to pretend like the Republican Party has left me, yeah, maybe because they did a website called Lion Comey. But, and for that, you know, maybe that would be a good reason for me to leave a party. But I wouldn't make it about the Republicans have changed at all. No, the Republicans are exactly who they have always been. It just so happens that you now have the ability to see it because they're writing a website calling you Lion Comey.
Well, that's absolutely true. And of course, you know, I mean, we're talking about policy there. And I do think that Trump has done something that other Republicans haven't done. He's exploded all of these norms and rules of how a president communicates, what he says, how he makes decisions, the structure of the presidency.
It's all performative and about decorum, but there's from a policy standpoint, there's nothing
else. I mean, I think he's made the rest of the world very nervous because he is a person who they do not understand.
But Comey's argument is that the Republican Party has left him, and frankly, the Republican Party. Yeah. This is who the Republican Party is. Donald Trump is not some type of aberration. He is the natural product of years of grooming the Republican base. And, Mitt Romney, who James Comey.
The Republican base is with him. They are with him. They are sticking with him. That base, that 40%, 35 to 40% of people, it doesn't matter what Donald Trump does because in fact, the performative aspect of it is what they love about him. That's the good part. The policy is completely irrelevant.
80% of Republicans still support Donald Trump. And Mitt Romney, who James Comey went out of his way to praise, I remind everybody, Mitt Romney, 4.5 years ago, now 6 years ago, flew to New York to get Donald Trump's imprimatur and blessing when it came time for him to be the Republican nominee in 2012. So the idea that somehow this is some type of new Republican Party, no. It's just that they made a website saying you're a liar. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'm Sam Sear. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I got caught when I was young, kicking shins, throwing glass like brittle scarf. That boy's gone now.
Sam Cedar here. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio.
We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby.
So, Digby, the other big story that runs in parallel, of course, is that we are still in the wake of the bombing of Syria, which, like I said at the top of the program, I have to say that
I would have preferred no bombing of Syria whatsoever. But if we were going to, you know, if all the guys needed to basically compare their manhoods and so that they could all walk away feeling impressed with themselves, this seems to have been the best case scenario insofar as there were no casualties that have been reported anyways. And everybody had the opportunity to pretend like they won. And so nobody felt it necessary from domestic pressure or otherwise to engage further in a war. But, of course, we still have the folks like John Bolton and, you know, Sean Hannity, who are the president's chief advisors, it appears, you know, more than willing to engage in military conflicts going forward. But what's interesting is earlier in the week, we heard, particularly from Nikki Haley, that there were sanctions against Russia. Then we heard that they were off and that Nikki Haley was confused and Nikki Haley would have none of it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, this whole thing with Trump and Syria, Bolton, Haley, and General Mattis, I don't know what happened to John Kelly. He seems to have disappeared. But this seems to be the core group that was sort of dealing with this situation in Syria of the top-level advisors. And, you know, it's exactly as you say. This was sort of designed to allow everybody to feel like they had, you know, swung, you know, their big stick around, and they all got to, you know, shoot some, so make things go boom, okay? So that
right.
was fine. I mean, it was fine to the extent that if that had to happen. Now, Trump also has a little problem because Russia is deeply involved in Syria, and this is really kind of starting to look like it's sort of a Cold War confrontation sort of thing happening there. And Trump has a problem because he both has to, you know, he can't in the face of something like this gas attack where people are genuinely appalled at the behavior of the Assad government or what appears to be the Assad government, and you know, sort of reflexively want the United States to make a statement or do something about it. And he, of course, wants to prove that he's manly and shake his big stick around. But he also can't afford, apparently, to in any way insult or confront the Russian government. So this was provided a very nice little scenario for him. They released information to the public that Trump really wanted to go after Syria. They were going to do it. They were going to bomb. He sent out a tweet saying that he was going to, you know, the Russians, if they tried anything, he was sending the smart missiles over there. You know, he did this thing which everybody goes, oh my God, he's confronting Russia. Well, it's kabuki. I mean, let's face it. What happened was is that Trump said these things with full knowledge that that was not going to happen. And Mattis let him sort of let the word go forth that Trump really wanted to do the big strike, but Mattis
right.
talked him down, and they did the controlled, prudent strike that ended up happening. But, you know, Trump was really chomping at the bit and wanted to do it anyway and all that stuff. So, you know, this is a kabuki dance designed to allow Trump to pretend like he wanted to go to war and then not really do it.
He was held
so that,
back.
You know, he could wink and nod at his
right.
pal, Vladimir Putin. And then you've got Nikki Haley there, who's actually trying to do the diplomatic side of this, right? I mean, she's working, you know, all of this stuff on that side. You know, I'm not a big fan of hers. I don't think she's great. I think she's confronting in ways that are counterproductive. But nonetheless, she's not dropping bombs.
Right.
And she's out there saying, we're going to institute more sanctions on Russia immediately after this Syrian strike. That was going to be the punishment. Obviously, that had been decided in the White House that's what they were going to do. Suddenly, Trump just changed his mind out of the blue. Everybody's going, okay, all right, so we're not going to do that. Meanwhile, word also comes out that Trump was very upset about the last sanctions, where we expelled 60 of the the spies that were in the United States, and he was upset about it, and we shouldn't have expelled as many as we did, et cetera, et cetera. So once again, we're back to Trump being seemingly almost desperate not to upset the Russian government. And, you know, again, here we are. This one really let Nikki Haley out to dry. She was upset. She was mad. She came out and said, well, you know.
I don't get confused.
I don't get confused. You know, with all due respect, no, it's not me. And Larry Kudlow had to come out and crawl around like some kind of a mealybug trying to clean things up. But this was a very, you know, kind of ugly thing. It makes me wonder how long Nikki Haley's going to last. Now, of course, the gossip, the palace intrigue, is that Trump doesn't like her because he's heard word that she and Pence are scheming to take him on in 2020.
It's possible. I mean, you know, we just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, what is this series of events really it looks super strange for Donald Trump. I mean, putting on an embargo like this seems to have no political cost. It's not like there's a constituency out there that wants him not to do it. He really went out of his way to reverse what clearly everyone thought was the sort of the minimum reaction the United States should have to something like this chemical weapons attack. But Digby, we're out of time. As always, I appreciate it so much. Always great to talk to you.
My pleasure, Sam. Thanks.
Just ahead, the bizarre case involving the popular medicine Motrin. Why attorney Brian Witzer refuses to give up his fight against Johnson & Johnson. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Seder. We'll be back with a new show next week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Last week, I was in Las Vegas, Nevada for the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference, interviewing some of the top plaintiff lawyers in the country. Here's an interview with Brian Witzer, who's taking on the company Johnson & Johnson over a miswarning label on Motrin. Sitting with me now is Brian Witzer of the law offices of Brian D. Witzer. So, Brian, just give me a sense of one of the cases that you've had that has been ongoing for an extraordinary amount of time, the Trejo case. Tell me about who's the plaintiff and what's the issue?
Well, this is an ongoing story, as you said, and Christopher Trejo was a Honduran resident at the time he took Motrin at only 15 years old. At the time, he was a very good student looking to become a doctor. He was a captain of his soccer team.
And what year is this?
He took this 2006.
2006, and he's
and
living...
That's an important year because it's the year that the FDA had indicated that the Motrin label needed to carry a new label which said redness, rash, and blisters can develop with taking this and be on the alert. At the time he took it, the FDA had ordered that warning label to be placed on the bottle, but it wasn't done for 7 months. And during that seven-month period, he ingested it in Honduras. And the label which he had read did not indicate redness, rash, and blisters, which, of course, developed after he took the product for a period of a couple days.
Okay, and my understanding is that at that time, a generic version of Motrin needed to carry that label. Is that correct or no?
Well, at that time, he took a brand name product. So there was never an issue of a generic for him. His mother bought that product in California and then shipped it to him as a care package. He took it. If it had been a generic product, we wouldn't even be talking about it because, as you know, the law is horribly unfavorable towards generic. And we don't have that problem.
Okay.
So we proceeded to trial and got a $48.2 million verdict. It
No, wait, so because he got blisters and rashes, what happened to him subsequent to taking the Motrin?
What he developed was a disease called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. That's a process by which a good part of your skin exfoliates and falls off. And all of your mucous membranes, so the inside of your mouth, the inside of your eyes, the inside of your ears, would all just fall off. Now, the more extreme version of Stevens-Johnson syndrome is called toxic epidermal necrolysis. Short is TENS. And he actually had 100% of his skin fall off as a result of taking only a few days of Motrin. Now, had the warning been present, he would have seen that the development of redness, rash, and blisters would have caused him to stop. In his case, he made a very clear case to the jury in the fact that had it said blisters particularly, he wouldn't have taken it. Why? As the captain of the soccer team, he knew blisters were not just painful, but they were disabling. He wouldn't be able to go out on the field. And also, as a 15-year-old, 16, turning just about 16, he was a couple months away from 16, his social life was already erupting. And had he had an erupted face, so to speak, with redness, rash, or blisters, he wouldn't have been social. So under the circumstances, he convinced the jury that those three words, redness, rash, and blisters, would have made a difference for him, and he wouldn't have taken the product. He would have taken aspirin or some other product. It didn't have that risk. Now, subsequently, Johnson & Johnson, through McNeil, their subsidiary, wholly owned, has put the warning label, redness, rash, and blisters, on. So really, frankly, to the extent that this injury occurs subsequently, as it still does, you don't have a case because you can't argue around that warning. My case predated that warning change, in which there were many, many hundreds of individuals who had suffered this either Stevens-Johnson syndrome or toxic epidermal necrolysis. And they suffered it very dramatically. They could have had claims, but most never really pursued the remedy. They were really too sick or didn't understand their remedies.
Or were they even aware that it was the Motrin that had triggered
this? Exactly so. They did not know.
Because there was no indication on the bottles that you would have this type of reaction from taking this.
Correct. And let me go one step further. Sam, this is amazing, I think. One of the reasons we got $15 million in punitive damages on the case is because we had the following evidence. Let me digress for just a second, if you don't mind.
Please.
During the jury selection process, a young lady came up, an attractive woman from North Carolina, a very attractive blonde, and you could see that she was a Southerner, she was a Republican, she was the perfect defense juror. But what she said during the course of the voir dire, Sam, was that she was a Kelly temporary service manager. That rang a bell in my head that the defendants did not pick up. Here's why. During the course of the marketing and distribution of the product, head of drug safety issued a email which we got as part of 1.6 million documents in the production. No one that had tried the case previously, and there were six previous unsuccessful trials against Johnson & Johnson for Motrin, had understood the meaning of one of these emails. What did the email say? The email was a directive from the head of drug safety to the people who answer the 800 number when a call comes in from a doctor with questions about the product and its effect for one of their patients. And it was directed towards those Kelly temporary service workers who worked at the 800 number. So these lower wage individuals without medical training were taking in the calls from the doctors. And here's what that email said. It said, in the event of such calls about either Stevens-Johnson syndrome or toxic epidermal necrolysis being complained about by doctors, lower the diagnosis, change the diagnosis, and make it erythema multiforme. Now, the other lawyers that tried the case before I did didn't realize the significance of that is, and here's what it was. Erythema multiforme is a disease in which about 15% of your skin exfoliates. When it's more than 15%, it's SJS, and when it's more than 70%, it's toxic epidermal necrolysis. The difference was that erythema multiforme was not reportable to the FDA. So they were having these cases of SGS and toxic epidermal necrolysis, having been diagnosed by a doctor and reported to Johnson & Johnson and McNeil, their subsidiary, And they were purposefully downgrading those diagnoses so they didn't have to be reported.
And when you say they're downgrading the diagnoses, they're downgrading this in some type of form that they're supposed to submit internally,
sure,
or they're saying this to the doctors?
It's the internal reporting where they take the intake and they report it. You see, if those reports said SJS or 10, it would have to go to the FDA in a shortened fashion, in an expedited fashion. Because they downgraded it, they didn't have to report them to the FDA.
Okay.
And they never let the doctors know that there was the association between
Motrin
and the SJS and the 10. That's huge.
Now, is this a standard practice? Because, I think, for our audience of lay people, is this a standard practice that there are mechanisms for doctors to call in and report on what they have found and they associate?
Okay. Think through many products. They'll have a number to call where you can inquire as to whether or not something you're experiencing may not result from the use of the product and whether or not there's something they can do or be on the alert for, or, so that everyone can be keeping track of how often something may happen as an untoward side effect. So that's pretty common. But the fact that they're directed to misstate what's being reported to them by the doctor is a lie.
It's a lie.
So they're non-medical personnel changing and downgrading a medical doctor's diagnosis. That's huge, which is why we got 15 million in punitives.
Okay, so a doctor calls in and says, listen, I have a patient who's been taking Motrin. They have contracted TENS or the lesser version, the Steven Johnson. I'm calling to find out if there's any association. Am I the only person who have experienced this? Because if so, chances are it has nothing to do with the Motrin. It may have something to do with something else, and I've got to look for other possible causal connections.
You got it. And here's what the actual email said. In the absence of a description of bolus lesions, downgrade. So if the doctor...
Now what's bolus lesions?
Bolus lesions are a description of blisters.
Okay.
And so if they're not describing the bolus lesions, but, you could have that redness, you could have the exfoliation, you could have all kinds of things that are associated with SJS and 10. If they didn't describe bolus lesions and use that term, then they had the green light authorized to reduce the diagnosis. That's dramatic.
All right. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'm talking to Brian Witzer. I am at the Mass Torts 2018 in Las Vegas, Nevada. We'll be right back after this break.
Can you even see what you're fighting for? Bloodlust and a holy war. Listen up, hear the patriots shout. Time's up.
You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar right now, listening to my interview with attorney Brian Witzer at the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, about his case against the makers of Motrin, Johnson & Johnson, which resulted in a $48 million verdict after a 15-year-old boy developed Stevens Johnson syndrome. Brian, in the last segment, you were telling us about this Trejo case. It involved a 15-year-old Honduran boy who had received a care package from his mom in California that included Motrin. And he received this package in 2006 at a time where the FDA had already told Johnson & Johnson and its wholly owned subsidiary that they must put on the label of Motrin that if you get any type of redness or blistering or rash, cease using this product. It may be indicative of a greater problem or something to that effect. And it turns out that there were incidences where people would take Motrin and contract various severities of a disease that involve essentially your skin falling off and your mucous membranes. And they did not put this warning on for at least 7 months. You were representing this case, and you had told us that one of the members of your jury that when you were going through the process of interviewing them worked at a temporary agency that you had seen through discovery and documents. The workers at this temporary agency had been told that if doctors call in and express that they have a patient that may be experiencing this disease, that they should actually downgrade the diagnosis to something else that was below the threshold that required filing with the FDA. So they're basically hiding the incidences of these diseases. So, okay, so let me just ask you this and just stop for a moment. You said you got 1.6 million documents. Are you working as an individual attorney at that time? Like, how does a law firm go through 1.6 million documents? I assume when Johnson & Johnson delivers those to you, they're saying, good luck with this.
And they don't give them to you organized.
Right.
In fact, I think they shuffle them before they give them to you. And as I said, six trials had occurred before mine. None of them found that document and used it in the way that I did.
So is that just pure luck, or are you going through 1.6 million documents?
No. I'm going through 1.6 million documents. It comprised 90 boxes, 90 Beacons boxes, and I went through every document.
Wow. Okay, so you know this juror is going to, it's going to ring a bell with them that, yes, I remember getting that letter.
Well, she may or not, because she may not have been associated with that particular campaign or supervised those particular workers in a different state because she was in North Carolina. But she would recognize the import of a head of drug safety telling her temporary service low earners to downgrade a doctor's diagnosis without a medical degree. She'd understand what they were being told to do for so little money.
So the case turns on that, and then what happens?
Well, ultimately, we did win a $48.2 million verdict, and subsequently, another $4 or $5 million was added by the judge on the basis of costs, which, since they didn't take our 998, which is in California, is an opportunity to settle the case without incurring expert costs afterwards if we get a bigger verdict than what they had an opportunity to settle the case for. Subsequently, the case went up on appeal, and it earned 10% interest for 6 years. During that time, it went to $100 million. And at the point that it hit $100 million, 6 years later, unfortunately, the three-court panel on the appellate court determined that the case should be remanded back for retrial. So we are now preparing for a retrial in the fall. And although I incurred $3 million to prepare the case the first time, I'll now spend another $1 million to go to trial. But here's the thing.
Wow.
Sam, this was a 30-question special verdict form. And, of course, having tried hundreds of cases, I always try to get a general verdict form. Is there liability, and how much should they pay for it? Was there a duty? Was there liability, and how much should they pay for it? Unfortunately, in a pharmaceutical case with 60 lawyers on the other side, 16 in the courtroom every day against me, they were able to convince the judge that a special verdict form should be prepared, which had, as I said, 30 questions. Now, here's what they made the decision to give the case back for a retrial on. They said question number 6 should be question number 8, and question number 8 should have been question number 6. I have the following question, which I immediately stated to the Daily Journal when they interviewed me. How did it take them 6 years to figure out that the verdict form didn't pass muster?
And so what's the implication here? They larded it up with technicalities, hoping that something could go wrong, and this will give us some type of basis for appeal. Give me your sense of, and maybe it's too sensitive of a question you don't want to articulate this, but how just do you find that decision from this three-panel?
I've practiced 40 years, and I have always been sort of a Boy Scout when it came to the justice system from the very beginning. I have this deep, deep, deep belief, truth, justice, and fairness for all. And this had shattered me. This broke me down to my core. I've only had two appeals granted against me, and this same panel was the same judges that had taken that previous $4.5 million verdict away as well.
I hate to be cynical about this. Who appointed those judges?
Well, you know, it's various governors, and as you know,
so
California
state,
was a Republican
state court.
Yeah,
okay.
state court.
Okay, and so there's a predisposition, perhaps, and maybe it's unfair for me to say. I wouldn't ask you to say it, but I will say it. Predisposition towards barring the doors of the courtroom for any redress against a corporation.
A corporation of that scale, absolutely. Look, I'll give you an example, Sam. I did an interview for 60 Minutes, and it was a fabulous interview with Bill Whitaker, and it was supposed to be aired. And Scott Pelley called and said, be patient, it's going to come on. I thought it was a blockbuster and an important segment that they could offer on 60 Minutes, one of my favorite shows other than the Sunday morning show. And under the circumstances, it didn't get aired. You know why? Johnson & Johnson is a huge advertiser, and the executive board, they admitted it, the executive board would not approve that story for airing.
So this court is going back on to trial at the trial court and could theoretically start another 5 or 6 year process.
Well, that's what, you know, funders that we've sought funding from have said, so they didn't want to touch it. So I basically sold a 20-car Ferrari collection. I'm going back to trial.
Wow.
Nothing's going to stop me.
All right, Brian Witzer, Brian D. Witzer, people will be looking out for this trial, and good luck with it. It's a fascinating story.
Thank you very much.
Brian Witzer is an attorney with the law firm of Brian D. Witzer, located in Los Angeles, California. When we come back, former tobacco defense lawyer Bethany Schneider will join us to explain why she made the jump from corporate defender to consumer advocate. And if you missed any part of this program, go to ROFpodcast.com and become a member. You'll get the full show commercial free, or you can listen to any of our archive shows with all of your favorite guests. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey, this is Sam Seder. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio.
Welcome back to the third hour of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. This next interview was recently recorded at the Mass Torts Made Perfect 2018 conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. The purpose of the MTMP conference is for trial attorneys to come together and share information on some of the biggest cases in the country. Here's an interview I did with a former tobacco defense attorney, Bethany Schneider, on why she made the switch to become a consumer advocate.
We're continuing our coverage of the 2018 Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. I am joined by Bethany Schneider of her newly opened firm, Bethany Schneider.
Schneider Law PC.
Schneider Law PC. All right, so Bethany, you have an interesting story in that your career up until very recently has been defending... as a defending attorney as opposed to a plaintiff attorney, and you defended Big Tobacco. Give us a sense of the cases that you dealt with.
Sure. For the last 6 to 7 years, I've been working on the Engle progeny litigation in Florida, which stemmed from the Engle class action that was tried in the 1990s that went up to the Florida Supreme Court and was decertified as far as liability and damages went. So,
what does that mean, decertified?
So basically, the class action was broken up. And the Supreme Court of Florida said that each plaintiff had to go an individual lawsuit and prove liability and damages, although they would get the benefit of certain findings that the Engle jury made in the 1990s, which included things like tobacco companies were negligent. They sold a defective product that was more unreasonably dangerous than it had to be. Nicotine is addictive. Certain findings that... basically, we're already established in the case that the plaintiff's lawyers did not have to reestablish, but that they, each individual plaintiff, had to prove certain things like whether they were addicted and medical causation for their disease, and then had to prove their own damages, punitive damages, things like that.
Oh, so what changed? I mean, how that decertify? What is the standard to decertify a class? So it's really sort of like a procedural issue, and then it gets broken up into the specific
case. Well, the Supreme Court found that there were too many individual issues related to liability and damages in these cases that it could not be decided. Those specific issues could not be decided on a class-wide basis. That's why we have things like MDLs, is because, you know, they're...
MDL is...
Multi-district litigation, where and mass torts, right? Where it's not necessarily a class action where you're going to try all the cases at once. It's where individual plaintiffs are part of a larger group and the litigation is going on and there may be findings that apply, but that each specific case is a different case because there are too many individual issues on causation and damages to be tried together.
In your experience, is it your sense that the standards for being able to have a class action have narrowed so that decertification of the type that you're talking about is more likely to happen now? Like, and to a certain extent, that is, that could be characterized, I think, in my opinion, as sort of making the doorway to the courthouse a little bit narrower for people. I mean, is that fair?
I mean, I can't speak to how it's changed over time. Certainly in the types of cases that we're seeing dealing with drugs, you know, medical devices, things that affect people differently, there certainly is much more narrowed view of class actions. I mean, you're seeing more class actions on the consumer side. So it's not a lot of causation issues. It's not a lot of individual issues. But certainly when you're dealing with medical histories or damages, then it's going to be a much, you know, narrower ability to say, oh, everybody was affected in the same way and everybody was damaged in the same way.
So when you're a defense attorney and you're dealing with that case and it's decertified, you're happy. Yeah, because you know that you have more resources than perhaps these individual plaintiffs. Is
right.
That
I mean, if you see for the Engel progeny case, or the Engel case, when it was decertified, there were 5,000 plaintiffs that were signed up. So then, you know, as a defense lawyer, saying, okay, all these people are going to have to go and prove their own case, and that's going to take a really long time. In fact, I think there was some estimate that it would be like, you know, 2233 by the time all these cases would get tried. And that's certainly much more favorable to the defendant than it is to each of these individual plaintiffs.
And you're working for tobacco, and they have a lot of cash. I mean, isn't that part of the dynamic too? That the defendants feel like not only is it if I have to pay out all 5,000 of these cases, which is unlikely, but if I do, I'm able to extend the period of time that I have to pay that out, but I've got the resources. So those 5,000 people, like, how many will end up, let me put it this way, how many of those 5,000 will end up actually pursuing cases against that defendant?
I mean, I think it just is a matter of, you know, how long it takes. Now, it's not only, oh, well, we have enough, you know, money to push it out. It's that there's no way a settlement would be possible. These are $50 million cases. I mean, right before I left King & Spalding, there was a $42 million verdict I wasn't involved in. But that's how valuable these cases are. Now, there are also defense verdicts. But there's no way it would bankrupt the company to have to pay out a settlement. You know, you would not be able to come up with a settlement figure that would adequately compensate the people who deserve compensation, while also compensating maybe people who don't deserve it as much. Because certainly in those 5,000 cases, there are some cases that aren't worth as much as other cases. And so it would just be impossible, really,
well,
to come up with a settlement.
Well, all 5,000 of those people who were involved in a class action suit, which is much less onerous to those individual plaintiffs than going and bringing their own case.
They weren't involved in the class action because there were only a few named plaintiffs when the class action happened in the 1990s. So when it was decertified, there was a year where plaintiffs were allowed to sign up. And so that's when all those people signed up, was once it was already decertified. They signed up knowing they would have their own individual case.
Wow. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bethany Schneider about her decision to leave the defense side of this and start a plaintiff practice and what cases she intends to pursue. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. We are in Las Vegas, Nevada for Mass Torts 2018. We'll be right back after this.
Well, maybe it's the common curse. curse. Maybe things get bad before they get worse. I don't want to become someone who can't live up to what I already done. Don't kill it just to figure it out. Well, it rains and pours and then it runs out. I was crying on the bathroom floor.
Sam Cedar here. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now we're listening to an interview I recorded last week with former defense attorney Bethany Schneider on her switch to become a consumer advocate.
With me is Bethany Schneider. She was a defendant's attorney for about 7 years. Eight and a half years. At least part of that was defending big tobacco. And you have since left the defense side of things to become a plaintiff's attorney. Why?
So over the last year, I realized that over the course of the 24 trials I'd been to, I had done everything in the courtroom except pick a jury. So I felt like I had built the skills I needed to be able to figure out, okay, what is my career going to look like? Do I want to be a defense lawyer? Do I want to spend my career defending corporations? Because as you all know, as we all know, the longer you stay at a big law firm, the tighter those golden handcuffs are going to be. And so I felt like this was the perfect time to really do soul searching to see how I wanted to spend the rest of my life and how I wanted to use the skills that I had built at King & Spalding and doing the tobacco litigation, which was excellent training for a younger associate, and decided that where my heart really was in the plaintiff's side. I mean, when I went back and watched some of the openings and closings that I did on the defense side, I felt like the characteristics that I think are going to make me a great lawyer, passion, emotion, compassion, those are the things that I think really are more plaintiff lawyer characteristics.
I want to tease that out because, you know, I have been coming to this conference for, 7 years. And there's some folks here who are pursuing making a lot of money as plaintiff's attorney, but there's a lot of folks here who have a deep commitment to social justice. They have a pretty healthy anti-corporate streak. Tease that out. I mean, when you say you feel more comfortable going in, what does that actually mean?
So as a defense lawyer, your job is to deflate the emotion, stifle passion, you know, really try to take all of that out of the courtroom. And what I was seeing when I was looking at
dehumanize it.
Exactly.
Because the victims are always people, and you want to keep the jury from being conscious of that.
Right. I mean, you want to be, yes, very much more like logic, common sense. You know, you're not going to want to do anything that's going to make the jurors feel anything. I mean, there, on some aspects in the tobacco litigation, as there are in other litigations, there was a lot of personal choice type arguments where that was an area where you could kind of use some emotion. But for the most part, you're wanting an emotionless jury as they're going in, especially when you're dealing with different sympathetic cases and sympathetic plaintiffs. So what I saw was that, you know, that was going to be something that I thought was my most valuable, you know, asset, which was my, you know, empathy and passion and emotion. And I was basically being critiqued for that on the defense side. And so, you know, I do feel for people. And I just in the, you know, 7-8 weeks I've been on the plaintiff side have felt so much more fulfilled being able to talk to individual clients. I mean, you know, starting out I'm doing pretty minor cases, but just the amount, you know, of self-satisfaction you can feel in helping somebody. And you're, you know, I've said, you know, I wanted to take my Goliath type skills and help the Davids, you know, go up against the Goliaths. And I think it's really been fulfilling for me. And I do feel that sense of social justice and trying to fight for what's right.
You know, it's interesting because one of the other sort of reoccurring themes that has come up over the years is as different attorneys in different types of cases, whether it was tobacco cases, and obviously you're familiar with a lot of the documents that came out in discovery, and we were talking before that, you know, these are decisions that were made 50 years ago, so it's tough for you to get an insight into what was going on in those minds. And I've talked to attorneys here who talk about the story of Remington rifles and rifles that were shooting without anybody touching them, killing people. The company was aware of it. The company was aware of it is up until, you know, very recently. It was very sort of like was issued a recall in a very subdued manner. Do you have any insight into the mentality? I mean, because you talk about you had pressure as a defense attorney to dehumanize the situation in the courtroom. And it seems to me that there has to be a certain amount of that that goes on within the boardroom when they're making these decisions that are ultimately like, okay, X number of people are going to die, X number of people are going to get maimed, but on the other hand, our profits are going to be X plus. And so if we have to pay out some of this, do you have any insight into that? Because that is the one question that always I can't wrap my head around.
You know, I think it's the same story that happens now, you know, with different corporations, even, you know, at different companies where people get so insulated or isolated from the outside world that when they're looking at questions of profitability versus safety, you know, somehow they're just able to make the decision for profitability. I mean, it's interesting because in the tobacco litigation, all of those executives who are making the decisions to, you know, keep it secret that it, you know, was harmful or not addictive were also smoking and their families were smoking. And so it's like, it's one thing if, oh, they all quit smoking and then kept on saying it's not an issue, but it seems like in a lot of these things, somehow these corporations are just convincing themselves to the point where they believe it, that what they're doing is either justified or they don't want to believe it, or, I mean, you know, but I think that it's always, we're always going to have mass torts. We're always going to have these types of products because people are always going to make the decisions to put money over people. And it's amazing that it continues.
What are the types of cases that you're looking to do to pursue in your practice? I mean, I know it's early, but I'm just curious as to where.
Eventually, I would like to do, you know, catastrophic personal injury and wrongful death cases. Specifically, right now, in trying to find my niche as a female lawyer, I'm specifically interested in sexual assault cases. I think there's a big hole in the Atlanta area for. A lawyer taking those types of cases. You know, I'm also interested in the talc cases.
The talc cases?
Yeah, the talcum powder cases that Mark Lanier spoke about earlier today.
Tell us what the talc cases are, because I don't think the audience necessarily.
Yeah, it's the Johnson & Johnson baby powder that they used talc. There's two different kinds of cases. One was a huge verdict yesterday in New Jersey that involved allegations that, you know, that talc contains asbestos and caused a male's mesothelioma. And so a jury awarded $80 million in that litigation. And there's also another line of cases specifically for females in that it causes ovarian cancer. And so there's been kind of different verdicts in those cases.
I mean, that was one thing, too, that I was aware of when my children were babies is don't use, I mean, it's called baby powder, yet horribly dangerous for babies. I mean,
well, I think
that seems problematic.
Yeah. I mean, I think right now it's been really more, you know, females using it, you know, as an adult. But I'm not sure that there's a line of cases yet on whether, you know, how it affects babies. But
okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us. If people want to know more about your firm, where would they go?
My website is www.schneiderlawpc.com. And then I also have, you know, LinkedIn and Facebook. So Bethany Schneider, Schneider Law PC.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Bethany.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Coming up, my interview with Jessica Pride, an attorney who specializes in sexual harassment cases.
I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
Awake on my airplane, awake on my airplane. My skin is there, my skin is this. Awake on my airplane, awake on my airplane.
You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. My name is Sam Cedar. We'll be back with a new show next week.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. My next interview from the legal conference Mass Torts Made Perfect is with an attorney who specializes in sexual harassment cases. Here's my interview with Jessica Pride on how the Me Too movement has affected her practice.
I'm joined by Jessica Pride of the Pride Law Firm. Your practice focuses on specifically, or a big part of your practice, are sexual harassment and sexual assault cases?
I do primarily, yes, sexual assault and sexual harassment cases. Our firm does an array of things from employment law to criminal defense and general personal injury, but I only do sexual assault and sexual harassment cases.
Right now we are going through a... maybe it's an overstatement to say a sea change. One can hope in the context of society, but there's a big social movement, obviously the Me Too movement, and a greater awareness of sexual assault. Is this mirrored in your practice, or is this relatively, you know, sort of this is the way it's been fairly consistent? It's just that there's a broader cultural thing happening.
I think it's both. So I can tell you that 5 years ago I started and it was me in my home office. And now we have 5 lawyers and a whole staff that are busy around the clock on these cases. So it had always been happening. However, I think the Me Too movement, the It's On Us, has brought light to a problem that has been prevalent for quite some time. And as a result of that, we have had people who weren't speaking up before coming forward. It's amazing to see that women get courage from hearing other women's stories, and that gives them the strength to then tell their story.
So there hasn't necessarily been any legislative or statutory changes over the years as much as a better environment for plaintiffs to come forward.
Well, in California, I practice in California, so it's been a steady, actually, progression to where we are today. A couple of years ago, they had the yes means yes standards in the schools. And so they changed
What does that mean, yes means yes?
So in universities, when someone made an allegation that they had been sexually assaulted, usually you had to prove that you said no. But as we know from statistics, most victims don't say no. They freeze. They don't say anything. And they think, if I just be quiet and I just participate, this sexual assault will be over soon. And so we were having a high incident of sexual assaults that were going unprosecuted and that weren't being, I guess, charged, so to speak, on a school level or investigated. And so the legislator got together and said, you know what, we're going to change that. And Hannah Beth Jackson and a couple other politicians in California said, we're going to change it to a yes means yes standard. And now what a perpetrator has to prove is that the victim said yes.
Okay.
Which is so different. It's a shift in the dichotomy of how we look at these cases.
So the burden of proof shifted, or the threshold shifted?
The threshold shifted. Now they had to prove that she said yes. And if not, he was investigated and then potentially, kicked out of school.
Now, was this a criminal standard, or a standard in the context of California university system? And so a different standard that might exist in a criminal court versus a judicial process that was just a function of the school system?
Yeah, so the criminal process didn't change, just the school process changed. And what California did was they said, hey, schools that are receiving California funding, if you want our funding, you have to implement this standard. And so what it did was it just held more perpetrators accountable in the school setting within the school investigations. So.
And is what takes place in those school situations, is that admissible? I mean, is that end up being a basis of a criminal charge, or in a civil action? Is that become a basis in those actions?
Potentially both. right? Any type of evidence that is acquired in a school proceeding can be used either in the criminal proceeding or in a civil action. So what we wanted to encourage, and the purpose, I think, of it was to create more investigations and to hold more perpetrators accountable, because we were finding, well, she didn't say no, and it was dismissed. Oh, she was just drunk. It was dismissed. And now instead we had a higher rate of investigations and in which people are being held accountable.
I see. So it keeps it in play, and there's obviously, as more evidence is turned up. And okay.
Correct.
And so do you have a sense of how this has impacted standards nationally? I mean, out of California, is California an anomaly, or?
I mean, I don't know for sure, but I heard that it was being used as precedent for other school districts across the country that were looking at this, saying, should we model California? I mean, California and New York, they tend to lead the way for new legislation across the country. So this is definitely something that is new. Something else that's new that's coming out of California was just in Sacramento on Monday for a new bill that they are trying to pass for doctor sexual misconduct. And so when doctors are under investigation by the medical board for any type of, let's say, sexual misconduct, no one usually knows about it. Patients don't know about it. They don't go online and look up, you know, to see if their doctor is under investigation and for what. And so this new legislation would say that patients have a right to know. They should know that if their doctor is under investigation for sexual misconduct, that their current patient base should be notified. Because one, we found out through statistics and looking at past results, is that when doctors are under investigation and they know potentially they're on their last leg of the tour on their way out, they repeat offend. And
really?
Then we have multiple victims. And so the hope is to stop that and to curtail it so that we don't have anyone else that needs to get hurt.
So is this the pattern of how legislation works in this field, is that you have different sort of social contexts or different relationships, you know, institutional relationships and professional and client relationships, and the reforms happen in each of those different sectors, and they begin to, I guess, encourage other reforms? Is that?
I think legislators are presented with problems and they try to find solutions to them. We know that they're talking about on Capitol Hill of doing a Me Too legislation that would deal with the current issues of sexual harassment of people by the legislature. So there's a lot of different things going on at this moment. It's a very hot time for reform and for protecting victims of sexual assault and making sure that this conduct is stopped. So I really don't think that they look at it as a piecemeal, like, hi, how can I? It's just that issue was presented to them. And so then they created a bill to solve it.
And I mean, we started off by saying that as people come forward, it encourages more people to come forward. I mean, is that sort of the same pattern that's happening with these different relationships? I mean, it's the, I imagine the issue with doctors has been just as eternal as anything, and probably even longer, perhaps, because you haven't had women in the workforce as long as we've had some type of doctor-patient relationship. But other changes in society have encouraged women to come forward and say, there's a problem here.
Most definitely. Right now is the time to speak up. And women are standing together across the country with men as well, who are saying it won't be tolerated anymore. From Harvey Weinstein to Dr. Nasser to, I mean, you have gymnasts, you have regular women who were, you know, just going to get health care from their doctor who were sexually assaulted. People are now banding together and saying, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. This is no longer acceptable. And in the past, I think society had kind of hushed that. And, you know, whether it was culturally not okay, because people would think, oh, it's going to shame my family if I come forward and say that I was raped. Or society, because, right, especially with a doctor, right, people love doctors. You trust your doctor. And all of my clients that I've had, I mean, I've had over 30-something clients just in that context, have all said the same thing. He was a doctor. I'm just me. I didn't think anybody was going to believe me.
Right.
And this is the day and age where we believe you. And what people don't realize is that the statistics for false reporting are so low. But our society gives us this false myth that women love to come forward and make false allegations.
I want to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about that. And and talk about how one approaches a civil action on these issues. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with more from the Mass Torts Conference 2018 in Las Vegas, Nevada. You're listening to the best of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder, and we'll be back with a new show next week. We're back. I'm Sam Seder. This week, we have interviews from the Mass Torts Made Perfect Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. Right now, I'm sitting down with Jessica Pride talking about the Me Too movement and how it's affected her sexual harassment practice in California. And with me now is Jessica Pride of the Pride Law Firm in San Diego, California. When we broke, we were talking about your practice, which involves sexual assault and sexual harassment, I presume, and the notion, I guess, that society has this perspective or has had this perspective that there's a lot of false claims of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and you said that the percentage is infinitesimally small. Well, how do we know that?
So, for San Diego specifically, that's where I'm from, and I've talked to the police department there, and they look at all of their reports for sexual assault that came in through the year. They look at, of those, how many did they refer for prosecution, how many of them turned up inconclusive, and how many of them then turned up, so to say, were made false reports. And in speaking to the San Diego Police Department several years ago, they had looked at their statistics for that year, and it had come back that it was 2-5%. You know, it was the boogeyman, or they had a boyfriend that they didn't want to admit that they had cheated on, and so they had said that. But the majority of claims were righteous claims. It's not fun to come forward and to be part of a criminal prosecution or a civil litigation or any of that. And I don't think people appreciate and realize what a survivor goes through after being sexually assaulted, then having to come forward and having to retell the story 10 different times, being accused of, you know, why were you drinking so much? What were you wearing? It's not something anybody wants to sign up for. Right. So why would anyone just decide, you know, I'm going to make a false allegation because that's going to do what I'm going to do for kicks today.
Right. And we don't hear this type of, I mean, there is... You don't hear this predisposition of contemplating that somebody's faking, I've been robbed, or I've been beat up, or whatnot. So, I mean, how much of your practice is sort of a job-related, work-related sexual harassment versus sexual assaults? And are we seeing the same thing in terms of harassment in the workplaces? In terms of people coming forward and being less concerned about reporting it?
So I guess let's first say it's sexual assault and rape are it's the same across all arenas. It's just if it's an employment case, because if it happens out of an employment context, we call it sexual harassment. But we're talking about the same thing. We just classify it different because different laws potentially apply and different insurance applies to compensate a victim. So I would say it's pretty... even across the board as far as...
And we're talking different from discrimination based on sex. We're talking about, I mean, where is the line from the discrimination that maybe somebody suffers at work that is gender-based versus assault?
So, I mean, usually it involves, it's touching, an unconsensual touching. It's your boss... You know, grabbed your butt, your boobs, showed you porn that you didn't want to see, forced you to have sex with them. You went to a convention like this.
Right.
You felt compelled. You had to go as part of your job. Next thing you know, your boss gets you drunk and he assaults you in the elevator or up in your hotel room. So I think that...
It's anything that involves touching in that instance.
And I mean, but sexual harassment is also saying things that are inappropriate to you. You know, saying... sexually explicit things.
So creating a, I guess, an environment where there's some type of sort of intimidation that's involved.
A hostile work environment.
Okay.
That's what we call it.
And so what is the key that you need to prove in the context of civil action? Or, I mean, what is it generally that I mean, what's the agenda of the plaintiffs? I mean, because I would imagine on some level, like, you know, it came out that Bill Cosby apparently had paid off people. Are most of your clients looking into getting compensation? Are they trying to get some type of restitution? Are they basically trying to say, like, hey, I want to take this person, you know, off the playing field, for lack of a better term, so that other women don't go through what I've gone through?
It's about justice. I don't do cases with clients who want money. If their only intention is to get money, I'm not their girl. I have found in my experience is that the rate of prosecution for criminal cases is very low. We're talking 5-7%.
Wow.
And so women who have the courage to come forward, tell the police department and say, prosecute this, put him in jail for what he did to me. Unfortunately, what they don't realize is that the DA has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened to him. All the jurors have to say, yes, guilty. And what we know is that 80% of sexual assaults happen with somebody you know. And so a lot of times it's behind closed doors, right? There's no cameras rolling. There's no one collecting evidence. And so a lot of times it's a he said, she said, which makes the evidence very hard to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So then that gives us civil court. Civil court, we are 51%. More likely than not. It's actually 50 and a feather. And so
the burden of proof is less,
which means we have the most amazing opportunity to get survivors justice, and because we need less evidence. I mean, I literally tried a case a couple of years ago that we had no evidence. The judge was surprised that we sent it back to the jury with zero evidence, but I wholeheartedly believed that she was telling the truth. And the jurors heard her testify. They heard the doctor testify, and he actually got flustered and ended up saying, he said, he got all pissed off and he said, I didn't call her a slut, I called her a whore. And that was it. That was it. They found in my client's favor and awarded her money. And I can tell you that, though, for my clients, it's not really about the money.
All right, so what happens to that doctor in that situation? I mean, does that impact his license? I mean, is that...
No, he's still practicing. That's another thing. So in Atlanta, AGC is doing this whole expose on doctors. And they did a whole investigation on doctors across the country and doctor misconduct. And they found that actually half of the doctors that were investigated for sexual misconduct are still practicing.
And so is there any public database? I mean, is there, and I guess this is the legislation you're talking about in California that you'd mentioned in the last segment. It is incumbent upon that. Would it be incumbent upon a doctor to say, like, not only am I being investigated for sexual assault, but that I have in past actually had to pay claims for, I mean, is that part of the legislation? Is there attempts to get legislation like that? Because I imagine if I'm a doctor, if I'm a woman, I'm going to see my doctor, and my doctor has had to pay out a claim or multiple claims for sexual assault, I want to know that information.
Right, you would. I would like to know that, too. But right now, it's hush-hush secret. I mean, if you look on the California Medical Board website, you can see if a doctor had prior disciplinary actions. But the average consumer doesn't do that.
Right.
They expect that their food is going to be safe. They expect that their cars are going to be safe. They expect that the government is doing something to protect them. And so this is California's move to say, you know what, patients, we are going to protect you. And we are going to force doctors to notify you that they're under investigation, and I think that's good legislation.
Yeah. Well, if people want more information on this, is there a site they can go to?
Senator Jerry Hill is the one that is currently working on that bill, and I believe I can give you what the bill number is, too, so you can look it up. It's Senate Bill 1448. All of the women's Olympic gymnasts went and testified in Sacramento on Monday.
Wow.
About Dr. Nasser. My client was there also testifying. It's really exciting legislation. I hope not only does it pass in California, but that other states follow suit.
Jessica Pride of Pride Law Firm, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. I want to say thank you to everyone who's taken the time to support this show and become a member of our podcast. And if you aren't a member, do us a favor and help support independent media by going to rofpodcast.com. Signing up for the full show commercial-free is the best way to help Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for daily news analysis and a slight bit of fun.
I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.